Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Monday, February 3rd, 2020. It has been a beautiful sunny day here in Nashville. It actually got to be 70 degrees. It is so rare to have these temperatures in the first week of February. It does remind us, though, that spring is just around the corner, and I have the notion to get out to the hardware store to get some seeds for an early spring garden. Oh, maybe some carrots and spinach. But certainly, winter isn't over yet. Today was actually a perfect day to record this particular podcast. As temperatures warm and we get a little more sunshine, we often see more bluebirds here in our yard, and people often associate spring with the bluebirds. And so, yes, today's program is about bluebirds. Attracting birds of all sorts to one's backyard has become a hobby for many Americans, particularly hummingbirds and bluebirds. They are fun to observe, and it does provide a great deal of satisfaction to make a little contribution to improving the natural order of things. I traveled this afternoon the short distance from my house to the Warner Park Nature Center to meet with Laura Cook and Diana McCluskey to get the rundown on the Eastern Bluebird, the Warner Park Eastern Bluebird Trail, and just what homeowners can do to attract bluebirds to their yards. And so, I hope you'll enjoy this interview about bluebirds with Laura Cook and Diana McCluskey. So Laura Cook and Diana McCluskey, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
So folks, we're here this afternoon at the newly renovated library at the Warner Park Nature Center, and it's quite a nice place. You have not moved quite in yet, but boy, is it pretty.
We haven't. It was renovated this fall, and they just finished up about a month ago, and we're hoping within the next couple of weeks to move in. We're really excited. It'll be the library, and then we have a classroom, and we'll also have our bird office will be for the bird program.
Super.
Will be here as well.
You know, I remember coming out here many years ago, and there was a cluster of older buildings here that was the very first part of the Nature Center, this is quite a far cry from that.
It is. It's quite the upgrade, and the learning center with the museum is a beautiful education facility, and it has a large classroom as well. So yeah. We're really lucky to have
any
that.
Listeners that have not been out to see this should definitely come. It's worth it, and bring the kids with you because there's lots of things for them to do.
Yes.
So today's theme is bluebirds, and I want to talk to the two of you. Laura, you are the ornithologist on staff here at the Nature Center.
Yes.
You may have a different title than that.
I'm the bird research coordinator for the program, yes.
And Diana, you are a volunteer.
Yes, I've been volunteering here at the Warner Park for many years, actually.
All right.
And my main job at the moment is to be the coordinator of the team that works to monitor the Bluebird Trail.
Terrific. Okay, we're going to talk about all those things. But first, I'd like to talk about the two of you and let my listeners hear who you are and a little bit about your background. Let's start with you, Laura. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So let's see. I have my background is in wildlife biology. I went to Cornell for my undergrad and Boise State University for my master's, studying reintroduction techniques for the Mariana and Hawaiian crow, which are both endangered bird species.
Okay.
Then I worked for a number of years for the Nature Conservancy. Didn't do much with birds, but really focused on strategic planning and large-scale conservation planning efforts. And then my family, we moved here in 2016. We'd only been here for a couple of weeks, and Warner Park was having their Hummingbird Migration Celebration Day. And so we came here to visit, and while we were visiting, I saw Diana McCluskey and Kathy Shaw were banding hummingbirds. And I said, tell me more. So I was hooked right after that. I started volunteering and have been volunteering since, started working here in 2018. And as of December, just last a month and a half ago, I became the responsible individual for the banding station here.
So you're originally from New York State?
I am, the Adirondacks, upstate New York.
Fantastic. Yes. So just living in that area is an inspiration to be involved in wildlife and conservation.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful.
So there's no need to explain.
No, yeah, it's beautiful, yes.
Diana, what brings you to this?
Well, let's see, my background originally was certainly not in nature conservation. I was trained originally as a nurse, and that was way back when, in the days of Call the Midwife, if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
That's the era in which I trained, and married and had children, and various moves with my husband brought me eventually to the United States.
Okay.
We had a time in Italy and Brazil on the way, but
we
turned up here. After that, we lived in Florida and New England. And while I was in New England, I certainly was exposed, like Laura, to wonderful things. And I did a little volunteering at some of the nature centers up there, a bald eagle viewing site, actually, in Connecticut, which was quite amazing. Then my husband's work brought us down here. And I did not know where I was going to find a friend. So I looked for around here. We saw a park, wonderful. So I came in, and on the notice board was a little sign that said, if you need to walk in the park, please call me. And so I called that number, and it was Georgianne Chapman, who was the first director of Friends at Warner Park.
Sure.
And we became friends immediately, and we started hiking in the park. She taught me the trails and the combination of the roads and trails so that we could teach newcomers also to find their way around the park. And then that led me to Sandy Bivens, who was the director of the Nature Center at that time.
Right.
And she said, okay, come on, I'd like you to volunteer here with me, and the rest is history.
Well, fantastic. And we're going to hear about what you're currently involved with here just in a minute.
Yes.
All right, so let's talk about bluebirds generally. Now we're not talking about blue jays, which is a different species altogether.
Yes.
Tell us about the eastern bluebird. Who wants to go first? Laura?
Well, the eastern bluebird occurs in the eastern part of North America, and we are lucky enough here in Tennessee that they are here year-round.
Okay.
So where I grew up in the Adirondacks, they were only there for just a couple of months, and then they would leave and go further south. But here, we have resident birds, and we probably have birds that are moving down from a little further north and spending the winter here, too. And so you may notice that you'll see larger flocks of bluebirds in the wintertime, and that's because you have sort of this mix of resident and migratory birds. Bluebirds are insectivores. They eat fruit as well, but they love insects. They are cavity nesters, which means that they need some sort of a hole. Historically, they would have just found a snag, a tree that had a little hole in it, and they would build their nest in there. And they still do that, but they rely a lot on people to be providing boxes that are acting as their cavity nest. A little bit of history, I think Diana will go into in a minute, but bluebirds really took a hit from a lot of the DDT insecticide that was happening in the 60s and 70s. Their populations really crashed. And so that was why there was a significant effort for people to be providing these boxes, cavity nesters for them, so that they can help build up the population.
So they were eating bugs that had been contaminated with the poison.
Bugs and fruit and, you know, everything else that was getting sprayed with herbicides and pesticides,
right.
Yes.
And I guess the classic story is that pesticide would degrade the eggs so that the eggs were not sustainable and viable.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's part of it, and I think there may even been some direct mortality.
Just toxicity just because of the poison.
Yeah,
wow.
I mean, I think in larger birds like bald eagles, there is an accumulation that happens, and that's where it shows up in the eggs. But I think with some of the smaller birds, there's potential.
No kidding. Okay, so interesting. And they're, am I correct to say that they're ground feeders?
Yeah, so
tell us about that.
So there are perch They love fences or snags on a tree, and they will find a favorite perch, and they'll sit and watch and stare at the ground until they see something moving around, and they'll fly down to the ground and grab it and bring it back up to the perch.
Right.
That's
an important thing. We'll come back to that.
Yes, we will come back to that.
because there has to be a place for them to be able to see and perch, right?
Yeah, they're not like barn swallows that are catching flying insects on the wing. You know, they need to be able to perch and observe and go down to catch their prey.
So this is not a bird that you would ordinarily observe in the deep forest.
Well, not so. It depends, I would
okay.
say. So, I mean, I think that during the breeding season, they definitely seem to like that kind of edge habitat and having the open area. In the winter times, we will a lot of times find them in forested areas, sort of flocks of birds in forested areas, flying around and foraging on the ground and hopping up and stuff. So, they can use a mix.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what's going on here at Warner Park with bluebirds. And I know that there's a project called the Warner Park Bluebird Trail. Is that the proper way to say it?
I think we'll call it the Eastern Bluebird Trail.
Eastern Bluebird Trail, okay.
And
tell us, Diana, what is that, and when did it get started, and what are we doing with it now?
Well, Mrs. Amelia Lasky was a very well-known ornithologist, and she started the Bluebird Trail, and she kept meticulous records of every bluebird, and she spent an awful lot of time studying the bird for like 40 years. She kept these records, and we have a lot of them here. And it was continued then by another lady, a lady called Virginia Price, and then eventually again by Sandy Bivens, who I mentioned earlier, and it's just been continuing, and we just want to keep it that way.
Okay.
So present we have, we'll say 50 boxes, 47 working boxes, and they all do very well. And as a coordinator, I have a team of five members who regularly from February throughout the season until the fall, once a week they go out and monitor the boxes in their particular area.
Okay.
As a coordinator, I sort of follow them up, make sure they're doing everything.
Okay.
Giving me
keeping
the
records properly,
etc.
Yes.
Okay.
I used to be able to do a lot more, but unfortunately I can't now, so I tell others what to do or follow them up. And train, of course. There's a lot to train a new monitor. They have
right.
to know how to approach the box, what to look for, and all the various things to take notes for. We take numerous notes, and all that stuff gets recorded.
Okay, so you say from February until the fall, you're monitoring every week.
Yes, at the beginning. Now this month, we're going out to check the boxes that are already there and to see what needs repairing or replacing.
Okay.
And then the next week we go out, we'll go and see if there's evidence of any nesting, early nesting, which could be just one small piece of dry grass or a pine needle.
Okay.
That's their favorite material to make their nest, is a pine needle or the dry grass. And then gradually the next week we'll make more notes, see how high the nest has grown in the meantime. And then our next visit, we hope, will be sign of an egg, our first egg in the park.
So each time you'll open the box up and look inside?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And our first egg is around April 1st, interestingly enough. It's one
it good is interesting.
One to remember.
Yeah.
And then we follow the a bluebird lays one egg a day, so about a clutch of four or five. And so it's she starts incubating on the sixth day, really, or the day when she's laid all her eggs, and then she'll start incubating. And that takes 14 days, and in that period we still peep in and see that all is well, and nothing has happened to the eggs, or in fact any other predator has come in, and then we have to deal with whatever has happened in there. But usually, most times, things go on okay. And then once the birds have hatched, We are still monitoring them, of course, and looking out for any untoward things that might happen.
So this is referred to as a bluebird trail.
Yes.
Now, is this a trail that members of the public can go from the start to end visit this trail, or do you encourage that?
It's not a long, straight trail.
Okay.
That is in groups around the park.
Okay.
And yes, members of the public may go, and there's boxes, but officially we don't encourage members of the public to just go and open up and look
in. No, of course not.
But yeah. they're all visible around the park. We have several as you come in this driveway. We have seven, is it? Yes, over at the Percy Warner Golf Course, okay. Which is does very well over there. We have some on the Harpeth Hills Golf Course, and we have others on the steeplechase area.
Mm-hmm.
So really they are visible. They're not hidden away because... Okay. As Laura said, they need where you're going to put the box is going to be in an open place.
And certainly the fact that the boxes are there would improve the chances of the viewing public of seeing a bird. Yes.
And often people, when we're checking a box, they'll come up and say, well, what are you doing? Are you harvesting the eggs?
Or
a strange thing. But we have a little brochure that we take with us, and we're ready with the answers and encourage them.
So interesting. Now, yes. Are the birds banded in the process of this?
Yes, we do band the young ones between 7 and 10 days. That's
okay.
The perfect time.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why is that the perfect time?
Because their legs at that point are the same as they would be as an adult.
I see.
And it's the feathers, it's not the perfect time, but that's how we judge how old they are.
Okay.
The feathers are just peeping through the, can't remember the name, what is it? The shaft, is the word I'm
looking
for.
Okay, okay.
Yes, yes.
Just beginning to show.
Right.
Okay.
And of course we band we catch the female, of course, if we can, which is very important for the records.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you have birds that are returning over and over year after year?
Yes, I think the overall research question that we're asking, there are two things. Is one, we're trying to get an indication of how the population is doing by looking at how many young that they're actually fledging every year. And bluebirds will have, if it's a good season, they can have three or more clutches in a from March all the way through September. And so we're trying to get a sense of how many young this population here is producing. We then share that information with the Tennessee Bluebird Society, and that gets rolled up in the National Bluebird Society as well. And so they're able to sort of look across all of these places to get a sense of how bluebirds are doing population-wise across the
larger
area.
So what are we learning?
Well, what we're learning is that they're doing well, and especially because when you compare it to how they were doing, 40 years ago when their population had really crashed. And so I think it's very encouraging to see that the populations are doing better, and I think folks have a better awareness of, especially now, we hope, of not using pesticides and herbicides and planting native plants and all of those things, and providing the nest boxes as well. So that's one aspect, is trying to get a sense. I think last year we had, from the time that our birds, our nestlings hatched, to the time that they fledged, which means the time they left the nest, we had an 80% success rate. And so before that, I think it was something the time the eggs were laid to the time they fledged was 55% or something like that.
Okay.
So a lot of the predation happens when there's eggs in there in the nest, because you have things like snakes and raccoons and
house sparrows
okay. The house sparrows are another that like to eat the eggs. And so that's one part of it, is to get a sense of how the population is doing. The other part that we're doing is we're looking at what we call recaptures. And so this is when we have, when we catch one of the adults, every single time we catch an adult at the box, we keep our fingers crossed that it's a banded bird, because that provides information to us about how old that bird is, If it was many times, most of the time, almost all the time, if it's a previously banded bird, it will be a bird that we banded here as a nestling. Maybe we banded it, you know, over at this box right here at the Nature Center, and now it's producing eggs, you know, a half a mile away. And so that gives us a sense of movement as well. So I would say looking at longevity and just how they're using the habitat and how much they're staying within the area.
I did read, preparing for today, I don't do a lot of preparation, but I do a little. there was one news account of a band that was reported from Minnesota or Wisconsin or someplace. Tell us about that story. Terrifically.
It's from Wisconsin, and I'm going to let Diana tell the story because she was part of this story.
Well, pull right up and speak loud. Tell us the story.
Well, I banded 5 bluebird nestlings on the Percy Warner Golf Course in 2010.
Okay.
And one of those nestlings was number 2251-20687.
Oh, yeah.
And then 6 years later, a very experienced bander captured this same bird in one of her boxes. And she has 150 boxes on her trail. So she's a very experienced person. And it was, in fact, raising a clutch of its own. Now, the mystery about this bird in Black Earth, Wisconsin, is that we originally thought, or most people feel, that bluebirds, they don't migrate as such. If they want food extra in the winter, they go somewhere warmer, which is usually south or perhaps east from here. And so to find this bird up in Wisconsin, one has to wonder, how did it decide or how did it get to Wisconsin? And so that's just one.
A mystery is going to not be solved,
no,
I wouldn't
and
think.
There may be a lot of others have done it, but it's just...
There may be a man involved.
That's well, my theory.
My theory was, similar to Laura, was that some Kentucky birds came down and, caught up with them and then went back with them to Kentucky. And similarly, the Wisconsin bird perhaps came down to
Kentucky. Now, do the pairs mate for life, or is that, do we know? They're a little fickle, are they?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Well, there you go. That's as simple as that.
Again, we do have the records of, it was very difficult to catch a male bluebird as an adult. This, obviously, in the nest, you're fine.
Right.
So it's not difficult to track what the couples themselves are, if that's the right thing to
so
say.
So the traveling men is what we're talking about. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's talk then about a little bit about what homeowners can do to bring bluebirds into their backyards, and I guess maybe things they can avoid and not do. For instance, pesticides on your lawn. But tell us a little bit about what homeowners can do to attract bluebirds to the home. I have to tell you, that's been a terrific hobby for my wife and I. To have bluebirds at our home, just to watch them.
It is an amazing thing. When we moved here, we put up a bluebird box that first spring, and I got bluebirds right away. I was so excited, and it is a highlight of our summer to watch those bluebirds. They're right outside our backyard, and it's just we enjoy it so much. I'll start off by maybe talking about some things you shouldn't do.
Okay.
And then we'll work to all of the things you can do. So I would say the number one thing you should not do is you should not let your cat go outside.
Wow, okay.
Cats kill billions of birds every year. And bluebirds, especially given how they hunt for their food, they're at the right height for cats to jump up and get them. And so I would say, if you really want to attract bluebirds and have them be successful, keep your cat indoors. So that's number one. Number two, we talked a bit about already, is just minimize the herbicides and pesticides. Don't use them at all if you can do it in your backyard. Anything else as far as things you should not do? Those are probably the two big ones. And then there are a lot of things you can do. And I would say one thing is you can put up a bluebird box, and we can talk a little bit about sort of the specifications for that. But I would say some other things are providing native plants, so that they, the more native plants you have, the more insects you have. The more insects you have, the happier your bluebirds will be and the healthier their young will be. Providing some trees and shrubs that produce fruit as well will also attract more insects. And, you know, providing water, especially. Yep. We have, as you know, there are some months, like we had mm-hmm. this last fall, mm-hmm. I was just putting out extra dog bowls out in my backyard just to have extra water for the birds. So I was saying having a bird bath or having water available is really important.
Okay. What are the specific requirements of that makes it a bluebird box?
Well, let's see. Without giving the measurements per se,
sure.
You need the traditional box is the rectangular box with the hole, which is 1.5 inches in diameter, and that's the perfect dimension so that bigger birds can't get into the bluebird box. Mm-hmm. Sloping roof, give a little protection, and as Laura said, they are insectivores, and it really needs, that box needs to be in a position where there is regularly mown grass in front of it, because they hate coming through any brambles or any shrubs and stuff. They like to be facing outwards to regularly mown grass so that they can see the insect and, of course, fly down and get it. They don't walk through grass like other birds mm-hmm. do, looking mm-hmm. for their food. So the position of the box is one of the most important things. And if a lot of people, I'd like another one now. Well, 100 meters is really the recommended distance from another box. So if your neighbor has got one quite near, you need to get together with them and say, hey, I'll better put mine around the corner of the house, sort of thing.
You know, so, I'll interrupt you there to say that I have two of them in my backyard, and mm-hmm. they're maybe only 30 meters mm-hmm. from each other. Mm-hmm. Now, what I will see happen is there'll be all kinds of behaviors around both boxes, but they'll only nest in one.
Yes, yes.
They'll do all kinds of, I don't know, mating or dances around the box. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
You're not surprised by what I'm telling you.
Well, the male shows her the boxes, and she chooses which box she wants.
Okay.
And that other box could take a titmouse or a chickadee, and so that's fine, mm-hmm. but he will actually guard those other boxes within his territory, and so that is why sometimes it just remains empty. It's part of its territory.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a bluebird box is open for chickadees, titmice, wrens, and nuthatches, which people get very disappointed if they don't get bluebirds. Oh, I've only got a titmouse.
Right.
But of course, that titmouse actually only has one clutch, so you have to be patient, and the titmouse moves out, and then the bluebird will probably go in there if that's the box it wants.
Yeah. And those mm-hmm. are the birds you've named are not predatory
no.
on the other.
Well,
on
the wren can be not the Carolina. I'm thinking of the house wren.
Right.
The house wren can, in fact, fill that box up with sticks. But, of course, they're native birds, and you just have to
clean it out. Right.
Well, yes. With that sort of wren, it's best to make sure perhaps your box is not near where there's a lot of sticks and wood and stuff to make it easy for the wren. It does make a lot of dummy nests, so once you know that it hasn't chosen that box, you can then remove those sticks.
I got it.
Yes.
So what's the ideal location for a bluebird box? Does it need to be on a post, on a wall? Tell us.
We're laughing because there's all sorts of debate about this, but go ahead.
Well, the perfect, I think the boxes that are most successful in the park are those on posts, poles.
Okay.
Then after that, they love the fences, such as mm-hmm. at the steeplechase.
Okay.
The trees are okay, but they are a bit more susceptible to predators.
Snakes and mice and such as that.
But they still try, and they're still popular. But I would say the best is on a pole or a fence.
Okay.
And you see, they just love these fences to the male, when he comes to feed the female, he does approach in stages. Mm-hmm. And of course, a tree nearby with a snag, don't be too clever and keep pruning everything, all the dry sticks. He likes to have a place to sit on so that he can watch his box and look for insects.
And I will just add, one of the reasons that the poles are more successful, the bluebirds themselves probably prefer the fences the best, but the poles are more successful in fledging young, because if you put up a pole, you should put up a baffle as well, which is, it goes about halfway up the pole, and it just prevents snakes and raccoons and other predators from getting in there. So the baffle is really best for having success with a nest.
Right. And so if you read on the internet, it'll say that they should be oriented to face the north. Is this something that's important or not really that important?
Well, again, if the bluebird really, really wants to build in there, they will.
Okay.
But really, south, southeast here, not to get the prevailing, they talk about the prevailing weather, but not sure about that really.
And I think part of it is just having it face out to the best habitat.
Yes,
is probably a better, that it has that nice view out where it can be. One other species I just did want to mention too are tree swallows. What year did we have the first tree swallow?
10 years ago in Pussy Warner.
So tree swallows are starting to increase populations here in central Tennessee. And they are cavity nesters as well. And what we have found, there have been some places where the tree swallows have started to come back year after year and may possibly be displacing the bluebirds. We're not exactly sure. One of the things we did last year, and you'll see it as you drive into the Warner Park Nature Center, is we did back-to-back boxes. So there, we have one bluebird box facing one direction, and then maybe 2 feet apart, we have another pole with another bluebird box facing the opposite direction. And what we were trying to see, we had read a little bit that you could actually get occupancy of both a tree swallow and a bluebird. So we're like, well, let's try it, and it actually worked.
Okay.
Last year, we had bluebirds nesting in one box facing one direction and tree swallows in the other. And so just for folks to keep in mind that if they have tree swallows, that's fantastic. That's not a bad thing. But you might want to think about some clever way to offer the bluebirds another opportunity.
The swallow would be an aerial feeder.
Yes.
Right. So they're not competing for food sources.
They're competing for the cavity box.
I got it. I got
the nest site. Yep.
Because they would use a similar cavity box.
They really like the bluebird boxes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. You all two have been terrific to talk with me about this. Let's, before we close down, talk about what's going on here at the Nature Center and how people in the audience can learn about what is going on here. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
I think that's Laura.
Absolutely. So let me just start by saying that this bluebird program is part of our larger bird program. Okay. Which has been ongoing since 1982. It was started by Sandy Bivens, who we've mentioned many times. It's a long-term bird banding station. We have, in addition to our fall migration, our summer banding, our spring migration, and our winter banding, we have a total of 16 research projects that are ongoing year-round here. One of the things that's unique about our banding station is that it's open to the public. And so I would suggest folks go to the Warner Park Nature Center website, and they can find the banding dates. We have a public banding date coming up on February 22nd, it's a Saturday, from 9 to noon. And then in the spring, we will start regular weekly banding sessions where people are welcome to come and observe us banding birds.
All right. And then if they get interested, that they might gravitate to being a volunteer or something like that.
Absolutely. Right. And I would just say they can go through, this program here is funded through Friends of Warner Parks. And so Friends of Warner Parks are always taking applications for volunteers, as we are here at the Nature Center. Mm-hmm. I would just say, the other thing is, part of the Nature Center, we try to incorporate birds and bird thematic into a lot of the different programs, but there are, on a monthly basis, a lot of other programs going on to get people outside, to sort of think about nature, explore, and they're all free to the public. So I would just encourage folks to go to the website and check out those. They're amazing. We have our staff of naturalists here have been here mm-hmm. for a long time, and they are fabulous. They're amazing.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Y'all are been great to sit down with me and humor my questions about bluebirds today. And thanks for joining me on the Mark Fraley podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.